Our study continues in the 41st chapter of Genesis. In our last lesson, we've just gotten through the interpretation that Joseph gave of the dreams of Pharaoh. We've gotten down through verse 32. I'd like to backtrack just a little bit here and go back and begin with verse 28 and briefly re-give this interpretation of the dreams by Joseph. Remember, Joseph gave all the credit of this interpretation to God. None came from him. He took no credit. He took no pride. There was no boasting on his part. He simply said, this is God's interpretation of the dream. What's going to happen? Verse 28, beginning, "This is the thing which I have spoken unto Pharaoh. What God is about to do, he showeth unto Pharaoh. Behold, there are 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt, and there shall arise after them 7 years of famine, and all the plenty shall be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine shall consume the land. And the plenty shall not be known in the land by reason of that famine following, for it shall be very grievous. And for that the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice, it is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass." So the 7 healthy cattle, as well as the 7 full years of grain, represented 7 wonderful years of full productivity and prosperity that were coming in the land of Egypt. Egypt was a very prosperous land, and it was to really be producing at its very height during this time. The 7 ugly cattle, as well as the 7 thin ears, on the other hand, represented 7 bitter years of famine that would follow on the years of plenty. The bad years, furthermore, would be so bad that the years of prosperity would be altogether forgotten. The famine would, Joseph said, consume the land and be very grievous. And finally, Joseph stressed the fact that the fulfillment of the double dream would not be long in coming. It was a double dream to emphasize the fact that it was established by God and that God would bring it to pass. It would begin very shortly, and Pharaoh should not be any doubt about that. So here was the dream interpreted by Joseph. Joseph got all the credit for being able to interpret it. And so we would have to believe, as Pharaoh would believe, that God had the power then to also bring it about. And it's an interesting thing to note also in this account that the 2 names for God are used quite selectively. When Joseph was speaking to Egyptians about God, he used the name Elohim, God. This is the name of God appropriate to those to whom God could only be known as mighty creator and sovereign. This is in Genesis 39:9, 40 verse 8, 41:16, 25, 28, 32. When the inspired writer of the narrative made comment about God's dealing with Joseph, though, he used the covenant name Jehovah, or Lord, as this was the redemptive name by which he had made himself known, especially to the people of his own peculiar promises. Genesis 39:2, verse 3, 5, 21, 23. So there is always a clear spiritual reason for the various use of the 2 divine names. And they're not just a matter of separate documentary sources, but they have a different meaning here for different people. Once Joseph had given the interpretation, everything seemed perfectly clear, both to Pharaoh and to his servants, to his officers, including those who had previously been able to explain the dreams. The interpretation was so obvious and so forceful, so clear, so apparent, that no one could doubt its validity. And they must even have wondered why they themselves had not been able to see this sooner, because it seemed to be so plain now. God, however, had ordained even their own ignorance on these matters as a necessary part of the great plan he was now preparing to implement through Joseph and the children of Israel. He made this thing happen like it did so Joseph could be in the position that he was in, so that he could then favorably entreat his own nation when they had need of the services of Egypt. And so we read in Romans 11, 33 and 34, "O the depth of the riches both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments, and his ways past finding out, for who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who hath been his counselor." So as we read this story of Joseph and all of these events in the book of Genesis, there are deep implications here. We can't get all of the meaning out of them. We don't know all of the ramifications. We just kind of skim the surface. But even doing that, it's a great treasure of riches for us. Well, at this point, Pharaoh's mysterious and very bothersome dreams have been interpreted. And they've been interpreted in a very correct manner. So as a result of this, it could be now seen that great trouble was ahead for the land of Egypt. And as this fact began to be realized by Pharaoh, he wondered what, if anything, he, the very leader of this country, was going to be able to do about it. His people were used to having prosperity and meat and bread and food in abundance. In fact, they provided food to be exported to many other countries as well. How would they react under famine conditions? Would they blame him? Would they lose faith in their gods? Would revolution follow? And especially if this Pharaoh was, as some of the modern scholars believe, a member of the hated Hyksos dynasties, thoughts such as these must have troubled him. This may be the end of this dynasty coming up now with this crisis. God had not brought all these things to pass, though, for the purpose of embarrassing or dethroning the king of Egypt. That wasn't the purpose here. As a matter of fact, his own control over the country was destined to be strengthened by these events. But the underlying purpose of it all had to do rather with God's people, God's plan for Israel. Even Pharaoh and his great empire were really as nothing compared to God's plan for his people. God's eternal purpose is what really matters. It's what mattered then, it's what matters now. And at this point, God's purpose centered around the man Joseph. Therefore, not only did God give Joseph the true interpretation of the dreams, but also he gave him an effective plan of action for Pharaoh. So beginning with verse 33, he says, "Now therefore let Pharaoh look out a man discreet and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt." So Joseph continued speaking after he had explained the interpretation of the dreams. And these are things that are going to happen to this land. They're coming upon the land. But Joseph is now instructing Pharaoh in how he should prepare to meet the coming crisis. This is God giving advice to Pharaoh through Joseph. So instead of living every year on that year's abundance and using it all up as the Egyptians had grown accustomed to do, and which most nations do in that situation, they would now need to put forth a program of savings. Not saving money, but saving grain. And the people themselves could not be relied on to store up for the coming years of famine. It's just not inherent in human nature to be able to do that. Human beings and human nature being what it is, most people will spend what they earn and more if they can, not only for their immediate needs, but for those needs that they imagine that they should have. The few individuals who would indeed save for the future would be tempted to profiteer when the opportunity came. So the ones who save would be trying to make extra money off those who didn't save. And besides all that, the need was going to be so great, you're going to have to overcome 7 years of famine, that this would have to be something done on a nationally based plan. And there's also the danger that a person in charge of such a program as this could become a self-seeking dictator, and the available food supplies would be in his hands and he would have all kinds of power. So the key to success to such a plan and the survival of the nation would be that they get the right man to be the chief administrator. The right man would be a deliverer. The wrong man could become a tyrant. And so he says in verse 33, "Let Pharaoh look out a man discreet and wise and set him over the land of Egypt." So Joseph is telling Pharaoh, you're going to have to find a man who is discreet and wise, a man who has honesty and integrity, a man who is upright in all of his dealings, but a man who has the wisdom to know how to bring this thing about. So Joseph's first recommendation for Pharaoh was to find the right man, a man who had the keen intellect and true wisdom, a man who could with confidence be placed over the whole land of Egypt to plan its future food production and distribution systems. Verse 34, he says, "Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land, and take up the fifth part of the land of Egypt in the 7 plenteous years." So this chief administrator would be provided with a group of capable and trustworthy deputies to help administer this plan. It'd be necessary to levy here a double tithe on the produce of Egypt during the years of plenty. Historians have shown that tithing was practiced in ancient Egypt and other nations as a form of taxation or tribute to the king. But here we're talking about a 20% levy, and that'd be very unusual, and it might be much resisted by the people. This would be something new and different, and especially if it were brought about by some ruler who was unpopular with the people. So the chief administrator of this plan would have to be so skilled in diplomacy and persuasion to be able to be of unquestioned integrity himself in order to overcome the natural reluctance of the people to such a tax as this. So we're talking about a man who would have all kinds of abilities, but one of them would be to persuade the people to pay double tax. And, of course, during these times of prosperity, this resistance would not be as great as it would be if they weren't so prosperous. So the plan could work if it was properly carried out. So verses 35 and 36 say, "And let them gather all the food of those good years that come, and lay up corn under the hand of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. And that food shall be for store to the land against the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land perish not through the famine." So here we see that Joseph further advises Pharaoh that the food which was gathered in this manner should then be preserved in large storehouses constructed for this purpose. The 80% that the people had left would be more than adequate to meet all their needs, as well as they could continue to export to other nations during these 7 years of plenty, and the rest would have probably been wasted anyway. So the food should be kept stored and guarded in warehouses in key cities throughout the land in order to have food available in the years of famine which would eventually come. This plan could certainly work if it was carried out right. Because of the abundance of the grain during these 7 years of plenty, the price would be low, or the abundance would be there so that nobody would have to give up what they needed. No one would have to really suffer hardship if it were handled judiciously and fairly. But the key to all this would be to select the right administrator. And there's no indication in these words of Joseph that he was trying to suggest that he himself be put up as this administrator. Such a thought really probably never even crossed his mind. He was not only a foreigner, but he was still a prisoner. He had never held any political office of any sort. He'd been in jail for over 2 years now. He had no training or experience for such a position. He was only 30 years old. And Joseph, no doubt, was not thinking remotely about himself being put into this position of the administrator of this great plan. But God had prepared Joseph for this moment. He had brought Joseph up to this time, and it was God's plan that Joseph be the man. As soon as Joseph had outlined the plan whereby Egypt could now save itself from the great famine, we see that Pharaoh liked this idea. Of course, it was an idea that actually came from God. It had to be good, sound reasoning because God gave it through Joseph. Verse 37 says, "And the thing was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants." So all seemed to be very pleased with the plan that Joseph had now advised him to take. They were amazed. They were impressed, not only with Joseph's ability to interpret the dreams, but also with his counsel that he had just given. And they also seemed to like his whole aspect and his character. Joseph was a man who was now appealing to them. They immediately realized that this plan that Joseph was telling them about was the one they should be using. And even though Joseph had been absolutely unknown to them only a few hours earlier, here he was a slave in prison, it was now very clear that here was a man of very unique qualities, ideally suited to administer the plan he'd just given to them and suggested that they follow. So verse 38 says, "And Pharaoh said unto his servants, Can we find such a one as this is, a man in whom the Spirit of God is?" So they recognized that he was a man that had some unique spiritual qualities also, not just a good mind on him and the ability to interpret dreams, but here was a man who was in harmony with God. This was the real reason for his other abilities. And though they could hardly have understood the doctrine of the Holy Spirit and the filling of the Spirit and the things whereby God works his deeds through men, nevertheless they acknowledged that in Joseph dwelt the Spirit of God. This is the Hebrew word Ruach or Elohim. They saw that he had very brilliant insights, he was deeply humble, and that he gave complete credit to God. Verse 39 says, "And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, For as much as God has showed thee all this, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art." So with no hesitation, Pharaoh immediately stated that there was none other besides Joseph that was truly qualified to fill the post he had just described. So the very position Joseph had described that needed to be done, now suddenly he is thrust into that position himself. God was clearly with him. Pharaoh could see this. Even though Pharaoh and his servants were pagans, they believed in multiple gods, they did apparently at this stage in history still retain enough knowledge of the true God of heaven that they recognized Joseph as one who really knew him. So verses 40 and 41, "Thou shalt be over my house, and according unto thy word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne will I be greater than thou. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, See, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt." So here we see that Pharaoh immediately appoints Joseph over his entire kingdom, secondly, only in authority to himself. Joseph would be the second man in the nation. He would have full power to carry out this plan that he just described and to enact and set in order all necessary rules and regulations and laws. Absolute obedience to Joseph would be required of all the Pharaoh's subject. Now this was a truly amazing development. Here we have an unknown foreign prisoner suddenly given the authority over the entire land of Egypt. The necessity for Joseph's long period of suffering and humiliation, the need for him to have learned patience and trust is now clearly seen. God had a purpose in all of this, a purpose in having him to be turned upon by his brothers and sold into slavery and eventually thrust into this prison for over 2 years now. Any other man so suddenly exalted would almost certainly have quickly been filled with a great deal of pride. He would have been overcome by the thinking of himself more highly than he ought and would sooner or later have been ruined by success. But Joseph was now prepared to take this. It was a surprise to him, but his last few years had prepared him. He had now been properly trained and mellowed and tempered. He knew that God had prepared him and that he would continue to strengthen and guide him. And though he had not sought this position, or even thought that he would ever have a position like this with all his responsibilities, he was now prepared to assume them when God called him. And Joseph also further knew that God would be with him in the further execution of these duties and responsibilities. It wasn't just going to be up to Joseph now. God would be the one who would be helping him, and Joseph would be looking to God for this kind of assistance. In verse 42 says, "And Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck." So at this very time then, before anything else happens, Pharaoh sets in motion Joseph's formal inauguration into his office. He gave Joseph his ring, which gave the owner the ability to place his seal and signature on official documents of state. He was given fine linen robes to wear, no longer the prison clothes. These clean clothes he just put on to come up and meet the Pharaoh shortly before they were cast off, and he had these fine robes now, the finest in Egypt, and a golden chain, which was a sign of his authority, was placed around his neck. Verse 43 says, "And he made him to ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried before him, Bow the knee, and he made him ruler over all the land of Egypt." So a royal procession of state was organized, a parade, we call it today. Joseph was riding immediately behind Pharaoh in a chariot that was almost as elaborate as Pharaoh's chariot was, and this indicated to the entire population that Joseph was now second in command in the kingdom. And as he rode, there were men who were going along the chariot, crying out to the people on the way to bow the knee to him. So quite an elaborate setup here, quite a great occasion for joy on the part of Joseph, and really on the part of all the nation, as they now were going to be able to solve this great problem that was coming upon them, the great famine. Verse 44, "And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." So Pharaoh made it very plain here that he was still the first ruler in the kingdom, but except for him, everyone in the land of Egypt must obey all Joseph commanded them to do. No one, in fact, could move hand or foot without Joseph's agreement to it, which is a figure of speech, of course, but nevertheless, it shows the absolute authority that Joseph was to have. He said, without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. So this is a all-sweeping statement about the power that Joseph would have. So was there ever a more sudden and complete change in condition in a man's estate? And this great exaltation of one who had been so low and humbled only a short time before is the most likely way that Joseph could be considered to be a type of Christ. We read in Philippians 2, verses 7 through 10, but he made of himself no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him, and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of things in heaven, and things in earth, and things under the earth. So we see that this is somewhat of a type of Christ on the part of Joseph, but it's not the true type. Joseph, even though he was so highly exalted, didn't come anywhere near to the exaltation that Christ has, nor anywhere near to the depths of punishment that Christ endured. But we now close our lesson with Joseph in this high position. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.